I now call this remote meeting of the House Climate and Energy Finance and Policy Committee to order. Good morning, everyone. We're going to take the roll.
Chair Long.
Present.
Vice Chair Akam.
Present.
Minority Lead Swedzinski.
Here.
Representative Bierman.
Present.
Representative Bowe. Representative Bowe. Representative Christensen.
Present.
Representative Franson.
Present.
Representative Grunhagen.
Present.
Representative Hollins.
Present.
Representative Hornstein. Representative Hornstein. Representative Igo.
Present.
Representative Lee.
Lee present.
Representative Lippertz.
Present.
Representative Liz Lagarde.
Present.
Representative Meckland.
Present.
Representative Munson.
Munson present.
Representative Stevenson.
Present.
I'll note that Representative Bowe is present as well.
Yes, Representative Bowe was unable to unmute. I apologize. Thank you.
No problem. So a quorum is present. We have meeting minutes from February 2nd, 2021. Vice Chair Akam, have you had a chance to review the minutes?
I have, Mr. Chair, and I move approval.
Vice Chair Akam moves approval of the minutes from February 2nd, 2021. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye. Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The minutes are adopted. We also have minutes from February 4th, 2021. Vice Chair Akam, have you had a chance to look those over?
I have, Mr. Chair, and I move approval.
Vice Chair Akam moves approval of the minutes from February 4th, 2021. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye. Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The minutes are adopted. So today we are going to be talking about building energy efficiency. And we will first be hearing a presentation from the Governor's Building Efficiency Workgroup and their recommendations. And then we will be taking up two bills for informational hearings. The first is the bill that stems from the work from the Governor's Workgroup. And the second is a bill on the cold weather rule. So for our first set of presenters, we're going to hear from the Department of Commerce and the Department of Labor and Industry. And I believe that Deputy Commissioner Adi Renaud will be kicking us off, if I'm not mistaken.
It'll be Ms. Pereshek from Department of Labor and Industry, and then I'll be following her. But glad to be here, well. Chair Long.
Assistant Commissioner Pereshek, welcome to the committee.
Great. Just going to share my screen. Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members, for inviting the Minnesota Departments of Labor and Industry and the Department of Commerce to present on the Building Efficiency Workgroup, its purpose, process, and the resulting department recommendations. My name is Kate Pruchek, and I'm an assistant commissioner at the Minnesota Department of Labor and Industry, and I'm joined by my colleague Scott McClellan, director for DLI's Construction Codes and Licensing Division, and Aditya Renate, deputy commissioner at the Minnesota Department of Commerce. In 2019 and early 2020, the Minnesota Department of Labor and Industry and the Minnesota Department of Commerce convened an informal short-term work group, the Building Efficiency Work Group, to examine the potential for allowing local units of government to voluntarily promote or prescribe greater energy efficiency measures for commercial and large multifamily buildings. This work group arose out of discussions during the 2019 legislative session around advanced building energy standards or stretch codes. The formation of this work group provided the opportunity to consider how new commercial and large multifamily buildings can be built to mitigate climate change through the use of renewable energy and improved energy efficiency, while taking into account affordability and user comfort. The work group engaged to examine this complex topic and consider various policy solutions. DLI and Commerce published a report with recommendations based on these work group discussions, which members should have a copy of, in December 2020. Of course, the broader reason to address energy efficiency in buildings is to help meet greenhouse gas reduction goals and address climate change. Buildings make up a significant proportion of energy consumed and carbon emissions. In fact, in cities, buildings are usually the largest aggregate source of greenhouse gas emissions. Since 2005, greenhouse gas emissions in the commercial building sector have increased by 15%, partially driven by higher heating and cooling demands caused by a changing climate. And as this committee well knows, Minnesota is not on track to meet its statutory goals to reduce greenhouse gas emissions in the state by 30% of 2005 levels by 2025 and 80% by 2050. The commissioners of DLI and Commerce served as co-chairs of the Building Efficiency Workgroup. Individuals asked to participate represented a diverse range of entities, including the commercial building industry, construction subcontractors, the Minnesota Building and Construction Trades Council, commercial building owners, representatives from cities that have expressed an interest in adopting advanced building performance standards, architects, nonprofit organizations with expertise in building energy efficiency, also affordable housing, the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency, Representative Long, Senator Senjum, and then Professor Richard Graves, director at the Center for Sustainable Building Research at the University of Minnesota, served as a technical expert. As I mentioned, the activities of the work group were conducted in the fall of 2019 and winter of 2020 and included 5 meetings, a written survey, an informal communication with work group members, and continuous feedback. In summary, the work can be described in several phases. So for information gathering and sharing, there were presentations from or about several units of government, as well as information provided by Professor Graves, Commerce, and DLI. The workgroup had the opportunity to learn and share information regarding various policy options. After the first meeting, workgroup member input was solicited through a survey, which guided the agenda and content of future meetings. In addition, at each workgroup meeting, stakeholders identified opportunities, concerns, and policy ideas which serve to inform future meeting content. Based on workgroup discussions, DLI and Commerce compiled key considerations to evaluate policy options, which were used in the workgroup's discussions of policy scenarios. After 2 meetings, DLI and Commerce generated 4 policy scenarios based on workgroup feedback. In the third meeting, the workgroup gave feedback on these scenarios in both small groups and large group settings. Members examined the scenario based on compiled key considerations, as well as general advantages and disadvantages and outstanding questions. The work group was also asked if they had additional policy ideas to contribute that were not already represented. DLI and Commerce then further refined the policy scenarios based on work group feedback and generated 2 new scenarios. In the 4th meeting, work group members gave feedback about these scenarios again in small groups and large settings. I will now pass it off to my colleague at Commerce.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Aditya Ranade, Deputy Commissioner, Energy Resources at Department of Commerce. Chair Long, committee members, we in the work group explored different policy options to encourage building energy efficiency incentives, which encourage building owners to incorporate energy efficiency measures, add renewable energy, and or implement other energy reduction measures. These can be in the form of loans, funding, accelerated permitting, et cetera. Benchmarking, these policies require building owners to report their energy use and can be coupled with other policy options such as incentives to improve the performance of buildings. But for the most part, we focused our work group effort on energy codes. So base and advanced energy building standards or stretch codes are tools that set minimum energy conservation features or performance measures. The base code usually adopted from national codes such as ASHRAE 90.1 and the International Energy Conservation Code is adopted by the state and affects all commercial buildings. Advanced energy building standards or stretch codes go beyond the base energy code and may offer a preview of what's to come, potentially paving the way for future adoption. So ASHRAE 90.1 goes through their 3-year iterations 2016, 2019, 2022, et cetera. Next slide, please. So while evaluating the different policy options, our key criteria were minimizing complexity. This was a major concern for many stakeholders as it could mean additional costs. Minimizing the risk of additional cost, both upfront construction costs as well as life cycle costs from an owner's, building owner's or tenant's perspective was also a key criteria. What we did not want to happen is creating a disincentive for development. In addition, providing needed capacity for building industry or other entities so they're able to meet building code requirements was a key design criteria. Examples of this include education and training resources, access to current rebates and incentives, ensuring project cost competitiveness through additional access to grants, incentives, and financing as necessary. And above all, providing regulatory certainty, avoiding uncertainty, and providing a clear and simple enforcement compliance regime was something that we talked about and considered thoroughly in the work group. Next slide, please. So the key metric that we used to track the future progress for the state's buildings on this journey towards net zero energy is Zero Energy Performance Index, or ZEPI, which was developed by Charles Ely to create an absolute scale benchmark for building performance and compare different energy codes. The best way to think about this is the scale ranging from 100, which represents the average performance of a commercial building in United States building stock based on a building energy consumption survey in 2003, and a net zero energy building score achieving a rating of zero. How far we can go on this absolute scale through energy efficiency versus on-site renewable energy depends on the cost effectiveness limit, which is essentially a payback period on different technology options. Just for reference, the Sustainable Buildings 2030 program that's applied to state bonded construction has a score of 20 on the scale as of January 1st, 2020. The current Minnesota Commercial Energy Code is at 48 as of adoption of the 2018 IECC on March 31st, 2020. Next slide, please. So the work group reviewed and considered the experience of other jurisdictions that have adopted more advanced statewide codes coupled with stretch codes. For example, Massachusetts adopted a performance-based code combined with prescriptive insulation, air sealing, and other design requirements. In addition, cities there have the option of adopting a stretch code. New York adopted NY Stretch Energy, a voluntary stretch energy code for local adoption. It was developed to achieve different goals by 2030, 40% reduction in greenhouse gas emissions, 50% energy from renewable resources, 23% decrease in building energy consumption. British Columbia and Canada set a goal to have all new construction to be net zero ready or maximum energy efficiency by 2032. This created an incremental step code for the base energy code in the province to zero energy construction, and municipalities had the option of adopting future energy code versions to meet their own climate action plans. So through the working group process, the different departments and agencies and members concluded that improving building energy efficiency would have a greater energy savings impact if code improvements were adopted and enforced statewide in the base energy code. So how this change is slated to impact future savings, I pass it on to Mr. Scott McClellan from Department of Labor and Industry.
McClellan, welcome to the committee.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. For the record, my name is Scott McClellan. I'm the Director of the Construction Codes and Licensing Division for the Department of Labor and Industry. This chart before you, provided by the Northwest Pacific Laboratories, illustrates energy efficiency improvements in both the residential and commercial energy codes since their inception in 1975 nationwide. The commercial code there is shown in yellow, so you can see its trajectory from then to now. But backing up for just a moment, I wanted to kind of level set the regulation in Minnesota. Minnesota statute requires the Commissioner of Labor and Industry to establish by rule and in consultation with the Construction Codes Advisory Council, an entire code of standards for the construction of buildings that includes, among other structural and fire safety provisions, standards specific to heat loss, lighting, and climate control, areas that are typically regulated as a Minnesota energy code. So as part of the state building code, the Minnesota Energy Code does apply statewide for the construction of buildings and supersedes any similar regulation by any local government. However, municipal enforcement only occurs in those municipalities that have adopted enforcement of the state building code. So back to the chart. So looking at the chart, the first commercial energy code in Minnesota was adopted in January 1976, there at the top, and has a baseline rating of 100 on an energy use scale from a 1 to 100. By comparison, the commercial energy code currently in effect in Minnesota has a rating of 48, meaning buildings constructed to this standard today use 52% less energy than those built under the 1976 code. So the graph does clearly illustrate the efficiency impact of new energy codes as time goes on, down till you get to where we are today, down around the 2020 mark. On March 31st, 2020 is when Minnesota adopted the 2018 International Energy Code. And buildings constructed under this new energy code since last March are now 16% more efficient than the previous code we had in effect prior to March 31st. Next slide. So the department recommends an adoption framework where the current statewide commercial energy code be advanced and accelerated such that it achieves net zero by 2036. A net zero building is a building that has become so energy efficient that the balance of energy needs can be supplied with renewable energy technologies. This proposal aligns with the agency's statutory authority and responsibility to adopt model commercial energy codes to improve the efficiency of energy in buildings. Additionally, this proposal recommends adoption of a new model commercial energy code as it becomes available every 3 years, beginning with the adoption of the 2019 edition of ASHRAE Standard 90.1. The work group did discuss either a 3 or 6 year code adoption cycle. However, under a 3 year cycle, the commercial energy code could reach net zero by 2036, where if we remained on a 6 year cycle, we wouldn't reach it until over 10 years later. But because the model codes that are produced by ASHRAE every year will likely be insufficient to meet the 2036 net zero goal, subsequent additions to the code will require some sort of an additional enhancement. So through the adoption process, we would need to add a factor in that to keep us on track through 2036. Next slide, please. So ASHRAE 90.1 that I made reference to is the national standard for commercial building energy efficiency. That's the basis for other national energy codes. The department's current process has been practiced has been to wait till ASHRAE is incorporated into the International Energy Code. However, instead, the departments are recommending to move forward with the adoption of the ASHRAE standard as it is used exclusively as the energy code in 9 other states and the basis for the international code in 30 other states. So the state code adoption process would take from 1 to 2 years once the updated standard becomes available. The department then would add this adjusted minimum percentage that I made reference to, in addition to the ASHRAE, and to ensure that the Commercial Building Energy Code meets net zero by 2036. And this does have the added benefit of making Minnesota compliant with a federal law that requires each state to adopt a new commercial energy code when the U.S. Department of Energy issues a determination that the new code is more efficient than the predecessor for the previous code. Thank you. That's what I have, and I'll turn it back over to Commerce.
Deputy Commissioner Renati.
Thank you, Mr. McClellan. Thank you, Chair Long. Issuing this report is just the beginning of our journey. There are a number of future research and other steps that are listed here. Education and training, providing efficiency resources, piloting emerging building models. These will help us understand how the expected energy use intensity compares with the actual energy use intensity in buildings. Going to different building segments and understanding how energy use intensity in retail versus office versus education versus hospital, how that changes is a key part of future research. Incentives and benchmarking existing and future energy efficiency programs in the state and how they impact or accelerate this journey is critical. And then last but not the least is examining how the building code enforcement is taking place in the state. What are some of the peer or behavioral patterns that encourage compliance? So lots of work to do. This is just the beginning. So at this point, I would like to hand off to Assistant Commissioner Pershing.
Assistant Commissioner. I believe you're on mute, Assistant Commissioner.
Thank you. I'm just here to wrap it up. We appreciate the opportunity to be here today. And of course, we'll be talking more about the related legislative proposal later in this hearing. And we're happy to respond to any questions.
Well, thank you so much. Really appreciate this presentation. And I want to extend my thanks to the Department of Commerce and the Department of Labor and Industry for convening this process. As I think members can see, it was a very thorough process with a wide range of stakeholders that were brought to the discussion. And the intent of the process was to try to reach consensus. And I think it achieved that, as we'll hear from the bill that we're moving towards next. These are big, complex topics, and the bill that we had proposed before this body last session did not have consensus, but I think through the work that both departments did, trying to bring everybody together and find a path forward, we have found a path that has widespread agreement. So I'm really grateful for the departments for their work and for all the staff time that went into convening these meetings. I know Senator Senjum and I appreciate them, and also for the efforts to bring your technical expertise to bear on this challenge. I am not seeing member questions. I'll just pause for a minute to see if there are any before we move to the bill. Okay, so we will move to our informational hearing on the House file that was posted for committee. And this is a bill that I will be authoring, was introduced, but is not in the committee's possession yet, modifying the energy code for new commercial buildings. And I think you heard the testimony about what the proposal would be, that to accelerate the adoption cycle to 3 years for new commercial buildings to reach net zero by 2036. And we have five testifiers to speak to this proposal, but I just want to underscore the importance of the building sector overall to reaching our climate goals that we've set as a state. As was mentioned, buildings in general are 40% of overall climate emissions, and we know that in cities, they can reach a much higher level than that. And I'd also like to thank the many cities that have been engaged with their own greenhouse gas goals and pushing forward on trying to help meet those goals by having more aggressive commercial building codes and better standards. And it really was the city's leadership in many ways that brought this conversation to the legislature, and we're grateful for their efforts. And with that, I'll call up our first testifier on the bill, and that will be Assistant Commissioner Parashek.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Wong and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of this legislation today. Again, my name is Kate Peruschek, and I am Assistant Commissioner at the Minnesota Department of Labor and Industry. As we discussed earlier, the Departments of Labor and Industry and Commerce convened a stakeholder work group to consider ways to improve energy efficiency in new commercial and large multifamily construction. The bill before you is the result of that work group. In addition to being the result of the Building Efficiency Work Group, the legislation is one of Governor Walz's COVID-19 Recovery 2021 budget proposals to address climate change, specifically to create more resilient communities. As this committee knows, Minnesota is not on track to meet its greenhouse gas reduction goals. Improving energy efficiency in commercial and multifamily buildings four stories or more is a key component to help the state get back on track, as greenhouse gas emissions in the commercial building sector have increased by 15% since 2005. Representative Long's bill takes a statewide approach to energy code improvements that ensures all new commercial and large multifamily construction is net zero by 2036. This legislation aligns with the agency's statutory responsibility to adopt model commercial energy codes and consider amendments to the code to improve the efficiency of a building. Current law requires DLI to act on each new model commercial energy code, for which the U.S. Department of Energy has issued an affirmative determination in compliance with U.S. Title 42, Section 6833. As such, DLI has authority and is in the process of rulemaking to adopt the latest commercial energy standard, ASHRAE 90.1-2019. ASHRAE 90.1 is the national standard for commercial building energy efficiency and the basis for other national energy codes. Adopting ASHRAE 90.1-2019 is the first step in the report recommendations. The legislation before you today is needed to require addition of a minimum 8% efficiency to the next ASHRAE, the 90.1-2022, and subsequent codes in order to meet the goal of net zero by 2036. This statewide approach creates uniformity, provides regulatory certainty, and minimizes complexity. It utilizes a national standard developed by industry and energy practitioners and preserves the agency's ability to adopt and adapt the code to Minnesota through rulemaking. Code compliance would be done through an existing tool the building industry already uses, minimizing new complexity. Compliance with ASHRAE is facilitated by ComCheck, a compliance tool paid for by the U.S. Department of Energy for each new edition of ASHRAE, which would facilitate enforcement. Improving energy efficiency in new commercial and multifamily construction means better buildings, lower emissions, and a healthier Minnesota. The Department of Labor and Industry is pleased to support this legislation. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Assistant Commissioner. Next, we are hearing from Richard Graves. If you could introduce yourself for the record and begin.
Thank you, Representative Wong. My name is Richard Graves. I'm the director of the Center for Sustainable Building Research at the University of Minnesota. Representative Long and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of the bill before you. I was honored to serve as the technical advisor to the Building Efficiency Work Group formed by the Departments of Commerce and Labor and Industry in 2019 and early 2020. At the Center for Sustainable Building Research, we manage the B3 guidelines for the state of Minnesota, which applies to all state-funded construction. The B3 guidelines include the Sustainable Buildings 2030 Energy and Carbon Standard that is scheduled to reach net zero energy and carbon buildings by 2030. a net zero energy building is one, as the report outlined, that has integrated energy efficiency cost effectively and then selected energy sources that are renewable. We are learning in the SB 2030 program that this can be done cost effectively and achievable to commercial buildings in Minnesota. The departments and staff should be commended for their work with stakeholders to achieve consensus on the recommendations. The working group recommended to have the new model energy code follow a similar path to achieve net zero energy for new commercial buildings by 2036 that we've been tracking with SB 2030. This is an important element of Minnesota's climate action plan. The code trajectory is important for new commercial construction. It will need to be supported with research for cost effectiveness and market capacity, education, training, and integration with renewable and energy efficiency incentive programs in the future. I urge you to support the bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Graves. Next, we are hearing from Cindy Steinhauser with the City of Rochester. Ms. Steinhauser, please unmute yourself, introduce yourself for the record, and begin.
Good morning. Thank you. My name is Cindy Steinhauser, and I'm the Community Development Director for the City of Rochester, Minnesota. It's truly my honor to provide this testimony today and to share the perspective from a city in Greater Minnesota and as someone who works closely with our building officials and our development community. The Rochester City Council adopted legislative priorities in January that included Green Energy Code, State Building Code work that you can see in the one pager that should be in your materials. The Council supports legislation that would enable local entities to adopt higher commercial building energy standards that would result in lower energy costs while reducing air pollution and contributions to global climate change. When we think about the built environment and reducing greenhouse gases, that is where cities truly can have the greatest impact. Building and transportation are the two areas where municipalities can control how much of a difference we can make. As we make our buildings more efficient, there's a direct correlation in helping us achieve our individual and collective reduction goals. The City of Rochester's legislative priorities also include support for energy efficient new affordable housing, as it will benefit struggling residents by lowering their monthly costs and the possibility that that costs of less efficient buildings are shifted onto them. This is what we refer to the equity side of energy efficiency, in addition to aiding our move to a zero carbon community. Rochester recognizes that unless we start approaching our work differently, we will not meet our reduction goals. Minnesota is behind with adopting and updating the code as we are currently using the 2010 code, building code and energy code. This change would just be part of the equation. Making green energy code a first thought, not a last thought, is a multi-pronged effort. In addition to code changes, we believe it involves education. It's working with commercial developers proposing projects to ensure they understand our energy goals and how to achieve those goals is important and has been key to our work here in Rochester. One recent effort includes a current apartment building that's being proposed. And as we worked with the designer to apply SB 2030 standards, they achieved a 67% energy reduction below the current base code. To put it plainly, the code currently allows for 3 times less efficient building and not using easy to access tools and equipment such as readily available energy efficiency software. This project was able to do so by using off-the-shelf items such as strategically placed affordable sensors, other off-the-shelf efficient equipment, energy software, and with minimal cost increase, we estimated less than 0.5% of the total project budget and well within their contingency line item. We were able to require these green code changes because the project involved public incentives. And right now we can't do this for every project that happens in Rochester. Lastly, the city did a recommissioning project that has a one-time cost of somewhere between $60,000 and $70,000. And we now realize $60,000 annually in operating costs from that savings in operating costs from that project. That's the economic side of this equation. We've been supportive of this work and in recent history have done things such as establish an energy commission in 2009. In 2010, we committed to being one of the first Green SEP cities in Minnesota. In 2017, we adopted an energy action plan. And in 2019, we were recognized as gold lead for cities, due in large part to our proactive work on energy efficiency efforts. All of these things connect to our larger energy and climate plans and goals, such as a 30% greenhouse gas reduction by 2025 and 80% by 2050, 25% renewable energy by 2025, and 100% by 2030. This important legislation has a triple bottom line benefit to communities. And we thank you for your time and the opportunity to provide this testimony.
Thank you so much, Ms. Steinhauser, and thank you for Rochester's leadership in this space. Next, we are going to hear from Andy Snope with IBEW Local 292. Please begin and state your name for the record.
Thank you, Chair Long, and members of the House Climate and Energy Finance and Policy Committee for allowing me to testify today on behalf of House File 831. My name is Andy Snope, and I am the Legislative Director with IBEW 292. We represent 5,000 electrical workers who work throughout the state of Minnesota. IBEW 292 supports House File 831. This legislation provides for an accelerated adoption of the latest recommended standards for a statewide energy code for commercial buildings. Building energy efficiency is what our members and contractors we work for do. We perform work that helps buildings perform better. Electrification, lighting and load control, building automation, building energy management, process control, and HVAC controls are all the tasks that our members perform, are trained to do, and continually receive training to update our skills to meet the latest codes and standards. In 2019, legislation was introduced to allow cities to adopt their own optional energy-specific stretch codes for their municipality. While we are supportive of energy codes and the work our members receive from the energy efficiency efforts, we had some concerns about the adoption of a patchwork of differing energy codes requirements from city to city. In 2019, a work group was formed, structured through the Department of Labor and Industry and the Department of Commerce. After 18 months of work with stakeholders, the recommendations presented earlier at this hearing are that result. This recommendation creates a process in which this remains a statewide adoption, as well as preserving established regulatory conformity of an energy code. This creates the statewide uniformity and predictability we support, and it also expedites the adoption process in which we also support. This legislation allows for the continued establishment process of involving industry experts through the rules changing process. We are looking forward to working with the Department of Labor, Department of Commerce, the cities and municipalities, as well as all the other stakeholders to be a part of the process to help implement the needed changes to establish an expedited stepped energy code adoption with statewide uniformity. Thank you for your time today, and I will be available to answer any questions later.
Thank you much, Mr. Snow. And finally, we are going to hear from Elizabeth Turner. Elizabeth, please unmute yourself and begin.
Thank you. Good morning, Chair and members of the committee. Thank you for allowing me to testify today. My name is Elizabeth Turner, and I'm an architect and founder at Precipitate. I'm here today on behalf of AIA Minnesota's nearly 2,300 architecture and design professionals in support of Governor Walz and Chair Long's proposal to accelerate Minnesota's energy code for commercial buildings. We have a huge opportunity to reduce green energy use and carbon production in Minnesota's built environment. Nearly 40% of greenhouse gases in the U.S. can be attributed to carbon produced by buildings during construction and everyday heating, cooling, lighting, and other operations. Because of programs like SB 2030, which governs energy standards in public buildings, we already know we can build more efficient and resilient buildings in a cost-effective way. SB 2030 is both meeting environmental goals and saving the state millions of dollars each year in operating costs. In the course of our work, we've learned that changes to building envelope, mechanical systems, site orientation, and more can make a dramatic difference in the energy efficiency of a project. Minnesota's architects are taking these strategies and putting them to use for their private sector clients, but it is time to accelerate the pace of review of Minnesota's energy code to help us translate that success even further into the private sector. Precipitate has had great success working with multiple project teams and contractors to design highly efficient and net zero affordable housing in Minnesota and Wisconsin. Recently, we partnered with a nonprofit developer and the Center for Sustainable Building Research to research pathways to net zero energy for affordable townhomes in Northfield. The winning strategy was an efficient building envelope, leading to homes that will use 60% less energy for just a 5% increase in upfront costs, which is 7% cheaper than a solar-only approach to net zero. When developers don't plan to hold on to projects for very long after they're completed, their primary interest is in producing a building for as little upfront cost as possible. Cost is a key factor in any construction project, but first costs should not be the only ones taken into consideration. Cost over the lifetime of a building, including operation costs, is the critical cost measurement we need to focus on. If Minnesota does not more rapidly update its commercial building energy standards, we are setting ourselves up to pay more in the future through costly retrofits and increasing energy assistant funding requests. Today's baseline cold building is tomorrow's energy assistance request. And we cannot rely only on energy producing technology to get us moving toward net zero. We must adapt our practices across sectors. By utilizing energy efficient and resilient design and construction strategies, our buildings will remain functional longer. But energy savings and building efficiency aren't just about costs and carbon emissions. They are also about the health of Minnesotans. A building with good envelope and mechanical system will be both healthier and more comfortable for the occupants. And the added benefit of reduced costs can greatly improve quality of life for people working or living in a high-performing building. Accelerating the statewide energy code preserves the existing uniformity and clarity in our code and ensures every community, developer, architect, and tradesperson is on a level playing field. Because better, healthier buildings shouldn't just be for some, they should be for all, and the building code is an important tool we can use to attain that equitable access. As architects, we greatly value and respect the code-making process. The Department of Labor and Industry conducts a rigorous, comprehensive, and thorough evaluation of building code proposals to make sure they work for Minnesota. We know that even on an accelerated pace, this process will retain its thoughtfulness and intentionality, take all perspectives into consideration, and keep Minnesota's best interest in mind. And we believe that the two sets of analyses included in the governor's budget proposal, the market capacity and cost analysis, will help ensure that the adaptive code is functional and meets Minnesota's needs. We need to raise the minimum expectation statewide to give every community an opportunity to build better, higher performing buildings to serve their residents. AIA Minnesota's architects are ready and eager to help move this forward, and we ask for your support. Climate change isn't slowing down, and waiting 6 years for the next opportunity to act means we will be acting too late. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Ms. Turner. That concludes our presenter. So we will now go to member questions, beginning with Vice Chair Akam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you to all of our presenters. I think this is just a really important topic, and I appreciate all the work that has come out of the work group and all the intention that was put there to really come up with some compromise solutions that are good for, that are win-win solutions. And so I appreciated hearing some of those today. And I think that, you know, the MPCA's update on the greenhouse gas emissions report, and especially with their update about the increase in our commercial buildings, this is just a really timely issue. So thank you. I think it's important. And I just had a couple of questions. And one of them was, and I'm not sure who exactly would address this, but it's in regards to, it's my understanding, this focuses on buildings that are four stories and higher. And so what about those buildings that are under that? And are there efforts to also update and improve the building codes for those buildings?
Maybe we'll go to Assistant Commissioner Parishet.
Mr. Chair and Representative, thank you for the question. So you're correct. The Commercial Energy Code not only applies to commercial buildings, but also multifamily buildings that are four stories or greater. So in terms of single family homes, that is governed by the Residential Energy Code, which is a separate rulemaking process. So the department recently considered the latest Residential Energy Code is not moving ahead with that one for a multitude of reasons that Mr. McClellan could describe if you would like, but it does move on a separate track.
Representative Akam.
Yes, Mr. Chair, if I may follow up. And then what about, so thank you for helping me understand what commercial entails. What about those multifamily housing? I represent the suburbs, and we have a lot of multifamily housing units that are three stories. So what impacts that?
Assistant Commissioner Parrishek.
Mr. Chair, Representative, that would be under the residential energy codes.
Okay, thank you. And
Vice Chair Akam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then I have a question for Mr. Graves, and it's really about if you can help me understand what some of the improvements are in the energy efficiency technologies. I think they sound very interesting. Would love to hear a little bit more about that.
Mr. Graves.
Yeah, so many of the technologies involved in meeting a more aggressive energy code are technologies that exist already. So some it's from the most basic things like better windows, more insulation walls, those kinds of things. And then as you get out into the more aggressive energy efficiency requirements that would be, it's the kinds of projects that are 80% better than typical that we're working on in SB 2030 now. Then you start to get into changing and using different types of mechanical systems that are more efficient. Often these are heat pump based systems and things like that that are getting more effective in our climate and also more cost effective as they're deployed at scale.
I don't know, Ms. Turner, if you might want to chime in on that. You mentioned a few technologies as well.
Yeah, so I think in addition to what Richard had said, thinking about not only adding more insulation to our buildings, but how we're arranging it and reducing thermal bridges, those are some things that we're not taking into consideration right now. Rearranging how we're building our walls and focusing on air sealing and reduction in thermal bridges.
Representative Akam, any follow-up?
No, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Hornstein.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, and I really appreciate this hearing. It's very central to our climate efforts. My question is for Mr. Snope, as I think and we think through the economy moving forward post-COVID, even as we navigate the COVID crisis currently, in a general way, do you have data or anecdotal information on the job creation potential for these increased investments in energy efficiency and some of the process issues that we're talking about today?
Mr. Snope.
Chair Long, Representative Hornstein, what I can tell you about the construction market is that we typically see a lag whenever there's an event. So as COVID came about early part of last year, we were still quite busy for quite some time until a lot of those projects came to a halt. And now kind of in a recessionary time, building owners are just a little less interested in making improvements and doing some of these energy improvements and just plain capital investments. So now we are seeing kind of a loss of work out there. We do have several members on the out of workbook and several members sitting at home because of the COVID effect. So initiatives like this would definitely help put our members back to work. Any time we kind of expedite that, of course, we also have to kind of balance that with the cost that would come about by initiating some of these proposals. But certainly we are ready to do the work, and we're always looking for opportunities to stimulate the economy and help building owners make a decision to invest.
Representative Horsey.
Mr. Chair, just a quick point. Thank you, Mr. Snope, and just appreciate all of the work you've done in the clean energy economy space. And my observation, Mr. Chair, is just simply that I believe that for the public and private dollar invested, energy efficiency is perhaps we get among our best return. And so I think that we should keep that in mind as we think about this bill and think about related issues. You know, we've talked about increasing the energy efficiency standard, you know, in this committee. And, you know, I think that as we move forward, you know, let's keep in mind the economic stimulus and jobs, you know, potential of these investments.
Thank you, Representative Hornstein. Representative Lippert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my question is for Ms. Turner. I'm just wondering if you can say a little, I represent the Northfield area, and leaders here are very focused on responding to climate in an aggressive way and also an equitable way, making sure that we're including everyone in the community. There's a lot of excitement about the project that you mentioned here and its potential to be a model for the state and for others too. I'm just curious if you can say more about the project, what you think, you know, where we can learn from it and ways that you think could be a model or what we can build on from this particular project.
Ms. Turner.
Sure. Well, I'm happy to talk more, but I'll be brief here. I think one of the things that we learned is, you know, when we have everybody at the table, we had the contractor at the table, the client, and this is supportive housing for kind of a very vulnerable population. We can make the decisions when we have an energy model that is clear and shows us that we're going to save 60% of energy costs moving into the future. That's not happening on every project. We had, you know, tens of thousands of actually like research dollars into it. And that, so I think that we know that it, if a team works together, we can build buildings more efficiently. But we need some kind of greater outside incentive and reason to do that. I know that, you know, the developer is going to this next project, you know, it's hard to say, well, we should pay, you know, like a 5% increase in cost because they're just trying to develop and sell those projects and there's not any kind of external incentives for them to do that. So I think this code change would go a long way in changing that incentive metric for more people to make the decision to do the right thing.
Representative Lippert.
Thank you, Ms. Turner, and thank you, Mr. Chair. And yeah, I think these two things, you know, need to come together. We have local communities that have the interest and are putting in the effort and seeing great results, but we need to have the state have a strong code that's leading us in the right direction too. It can fit together very well. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Swasinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just in general, has the calculations been done on what this would actually cost? So those upfront, it's been mentioned a few times, it'd be 5 to 15% higher construction costs. What that would actually mean in real dollars over the lifetime of if this was to be adopted?
Maybe I'll go to business. Mr. Graves might be able to speak to that.
Yeah, so keep in mind the bill's institutes basically a code trajectory that would step down and get more aggressive over time. So the initial stages of a more aggressive code, based upon studies that have happened in other jurisdictions and our experience with SB 2030 projects, it wouldn't be 5 to 15%. My expectation is it would be, you know, less than 1% for that modest level of efficiency. And the other thing that you'll see happen over time is right now the state bonded projects and the projects like the one in Northfield are a small subset of the overall commercial construction in the state. And what we've seen in other jurisdictions is as these kinds of measures are adopted as code, the supply chain adjusts and you have these technologies adopted at scale and the costs come down over time, which is one of the advantages of making this part of the base building code rather than continuing to do incentive programs and things like that, because you can still pay higher prices than you would if you adopt them at scale.
Hopefully. Representative Swasinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then also just from a technology standpoint, if this is adopted, we talked a little bit about the technology, just one specifically that I'm looking at. Let's say in 20 years, if this was adopted this year, would I be able to install a propane furnace or a natural gas furnace in a commercial property and or a four-story or higher multifamily housing unit?
Not sure who would like to take that. Would that be maybe for Mr. McClellan? Would you?
I can attempt that, Mr. Chair, Representative and committee members. The code and standard that we adopt in Minnesota is intended to be, and it's explicit, that's intended to be performance-based. That is, it's not intended to spell out how compliance is achieved, but it wants to give the goal. We're charged with creating a standard, 8% more efficient, 10%, whatever it may be. And it's up to the designer to come up with the technologies and the design to arrive at that conclusion. So I don't anticipate that there would be any exclusion, specific exclusion, if the equipment could achieve a certain percentage. That would be the expectation. Now, also keep in mind that the federal government does have a large part in appliances. They oftentimes will dictate what kinds of appliances can be used and approved for consumer use. So that could change over time, and the states wouldn't have any control over that. But assuming they're still permitted, they'd have to be of a certain type of efficiency, most likely, in order to be properly utilized and see the achievement. Hope that helps.
Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just kind of going to delve into, you know, commercial, obviously, so we're talking also about restaurants. And one of the concerns I've heard is the potential that, you know, if we're looking at zero emissions and we're looking at building code for restaurants, if you would be allowed to have a natural gas emitting stove or a propane stove, obviously a lot of cooks prefer to be cooking on that. Would that potentially exclude those technologies in future commercial code violations is because of the CO2 gas?
Mr. McClellan?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative, I can't imagine that they would be ever excluded because they're, I think the only technology we have outside of electric, which is not as efficient to actually, you know, produce heat and cook meals. So there are technologies available today that use the latent heat from those processes and scrub them and introduce them back into the building as usable heat. So I would assume that the effort would be more in utilizing the remaining heat rather than excluding a particular appliance.
Okay. Representative Swazinski, any follow-up?
Yes, thank you. And then this would be kind of more along the science side. What, you know, if this is put forward, you know, we've talked a lot about the reason for doing this is the climate and climate change. What change could we expect temperature-wise here in Minnesota if this is moved into law?
It's like,
like percentages or what we'd expect from a temperature standpoint, from a science perspective.
Deputy Commissioner Renate.
Yeah, so our initial estimate is the adoption of this would save 38,000 tons of CO2 equivalent per year by 2025. How that translates into temperature, I can get back, work with PCA and get back to you on that. But we do have the carbon estimate at about 38,000 tons of CO2 equivalent per year.
Representative Swazinski.
Thank you, Mr. Yeah, if you could, you know, equate that into how much temperature change that would make globally, that'd be awesome. Thank you.
Representative Bierman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This question would be for Ms. Steinhauser or perhaps Ms. Turner as well. I know a bit about what a leader Rochester has been in environmental issues down in the city. And I guess I'm wondering if you could comment a little bit on how that has evolved over time and what have been the factors that have driven the city to embrace this in a more renewable go in a more renewable direction. And I know Northfield is similar in that regard. There's plenty of people out there who want to go this way, but we also have cities that are not in step with this at all. And there's just this inertia and you need to get the ball rolling. And I wonder if you could just comment on a little bit on how you've done that and what sort of community outreach you had to build support for it along the way.
Steinhauser.
Yes, thank you for the question. It's a great question, right? And at the end of the day, I think it really starts with leadership and people, right? In 2009, when we first started when they made the commitment to establish an energy commission, that was brought on as a, you know, from the ground up. You know, the residents of this community identified energy and greenhouse gas reduction as a real priority, and the leadership, the policy decision makers, listened to their constituents, and that has continued to evolve and grow and get even stronger. And the most recent example I can provide is, you know, in 2020, the city took it to the next level and said, we're going to create, we have an energy action plan, and we have a greenhouse gas reduction goals, but we need to look at what things are on the horizon and how do we get to that end goal. And so things like recognizing that the RPU SMPA contract expires in 2030, and how do we position ourselves and ready ourselves to be in an environment that can go to 100% renewable that times with the expiration of contracts, as an example. Another example was hearing our community speak to now the triple bottom line in the equity piece, you know, economic equity, social equity, and environmental equity to our story. And so, for example, we established the Sustainability Task Force, and we're really intentional about who we put on that task force. That was a great cross-representation so that we could hear all opinions as it relates to how we want to be more sustainable and resilient going forward. And then as a team, working with our partners, translating that into real actionable things like setting goals, practicing and walking the walk, and walking the walk, not just talking the talk, and actually doing this energy efficiency work in our facilities, and then creating policies to help those early adopters who are the greatest, are taking the greatest perceived risk, helping to fund and provide financial incentives to those early adopters to prove this work. And so I think it's, as I said in my comments, it's no one thing, it's a multi-pronged approach about leadership, engaging your community and creating buy-in, having that shared mutual understanding and shared vision, and really helping understand the resources that are available and how accessible they can be. So it truly is a community effort, and it does start with leadership, hearing from their constituents, and letting that translate into great policy that is both implementable and provable. Right. Does that answer your question?
Representative Bierman?
Very much so. That local input is what I was, you know, just asking about. I guess the follow-up would be, how critical is state policy for your further goals in Rochester?
Ms. Steinhauser.
Thank you for that follow-up question. It is absolutely critical. And I just want to speak to an example around affordable housing, because it seems like every community is talking about affordable housing. Rochester and the state of Minnesota are no exception. We are going to be looking at a demand of up to 18,000 housing units by 2030. And the leadership needed to ensure that we are building more energy efficient units. I mean, currently what's allowed is, as I said in my example, 23% energy efficient. If you're looking at 18,000 housing units, and the opportunity that the difference between 23% energy efficient, or in the example we provided, 67% energy efficient across that many units, and what that can do to not only help us achieve our local goals, but the state achieve your goals as well. Good state policy is absolutely critical to our mission.
Representative Bierman, any follow-up?
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Steinhauser. I don't know if perhaps Ms. Turner wants to chime in as well on the same question.
Sure. Ms. Turner, briefly, and then we'll go to Representative Lee, and then we'll have to move on to our next bill. Ms. Turner.
Sure. Yeah, I think that really good, you know, we're seeing that the community conversations about resilience and equity often lead in the direction of energy efficiency in housing and buildings. I'm not only in Northfield, I'm working with the city of Bemidji and Bemidji State University on some resilience planning. That same conversation is happening there, Minneapolis, St. Paul, St. Louis, Clark, a lot of cities, but they're not able to do anything about it. They can't enforce that on anything kind of citywide. And so I think that's why state policy is, again, kind of critical to enabling cities to meet their own resilience and equity goals.
Thank you, Ms. Turner. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Bierman. Representative Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I believe this question will be for Mr. Graves. Mr. Graves, you mentioned about the SB 2030 program for bonding projects or for public buildings. I know that, you know, in this conversation, we have been hearing about some concerns with costs. Can you actually tell us, you know, from running and administering the program, how much have we saved through for the taxpayer of the state of Minnesota, and how could that, you know, provide us a context of how much the commercial sector can possibly save from something like this?
Mr. Graves.
So I'm going off of memory from my testimony last week in your committee, Representative Lee, but it's over $20 million per year in operating cost for the state of Minnesota through SB 2030. But I can submit the exact figures.
Representative Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so I would just like to follow up with Mr. Graves, if you could provide some of those figures to members of the committee so that we have a idea on the potential saving for the commercial sector. I think that'd be great. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Lee. That's a great point. And Mr. Graves, if you could circulate that, we'll get it around to the committee members. Well, thank you all very much for an excellent discussion. And thank you to our testifiers today and to the Department of Labor and Industry and Department of Commerce for your leadership. Next, we have up an informational hearing on Representative Akam's bill. And Representative Akam, would you like to introduce the topic?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Good morning. And today I will be presenting on an update to the existing cold weather rule that would extend the cold weather period from 2 weeks on both ends. And it would, as proposed, would be from October 1st running through April 30th. What I will say that last year has shown how important it is that safe and stable homes for everyone in Minnesota is super important. Given our long winters in our state and having, it's important that we have a process for those who need it to ensure that their heat not be turned off. To be clear, this rule does not mean any customer does not pay their existing bills, their heating bills. In fact, they must set up a payment plan and follow through on that plan in order to qualify. And I think one of the really important things, the benefits that come out of applying for the clean weather rule, is that residents can be made aware of heating and energy assistance programs that they may qualify for. So I have two presenters that are here two testifiers that are here to present this morning. One is temporary commissioner of commerce, Commissioner Arnold. And then also Chairman Dupuis from the Fond du Lac Band of Lake Superior, Chippewa. So maybe we'll turn it over to the commissioner to start.
Commissioner Arnold, please introduce yourself for the record and begin.
Thank you, Chair Long and members. For the record, I'm Grace Arnold. I'm the temporary commissioner of the Department of Commerce. I'd like to start by thanking Representative Akam for authoring this important proposal, and also to thank Chairman Dupuis, who you'll hear from in after my testimony. From the Fond du Lac Band of the Lake Superior Chippewa. He and team were the first to bring this idea forward during our tribal consultations. And I'm really grateful for his leadership in that area. So I'll add just a couple of things about what the cold weather rule is. So the cold weather rule prevents disconnections, as Representative Akam mentioned, for individuals between currently October 15th and April 15th of each year. Customers who have a combined income at or below 50% of the state median income are not required to pay more than 10% of their household income as part of their payment plan. And if they have a household income above 50% of the state median, they still have the right to have a payment agreement. Consumers using delivered fuels such as fuel oil, propane, or wood to heat their homes are not covered by the cold weather rule, but they are encouraged to contact companies that serve them to discuss payment options if they're unable to pay. So, you know, I think Representative Acom teed this up, but climate change is affecting the length of severe winter weather in Minnesota and is often creating the need for assistance prior to the current October 15th date and beyond the April 15th cutoff date. So if you remember just a few years ago, I remember vividly because I was 9 months pregnant and did not want to have a baby in a snowstorm. But on April 16th, 2018, we were in the middle of a thunder blizzard that dropped 15.8 inches of snow in the Twin Cities and more around the area. The following year, 2019, Minnesota was hit with another April snowstorm, which was 8 inches. Which dumped about up to 8 inches of snow in other parts of Minnesota. And in October of 2019, much of northwestern Minnesota was hit with a blizzard of up to 3 feet. So these all happened outside of the current cold weather rule. And, you know, we know Minnesota's weather is unpredictable, but what we've seen in the last year and in particular is that Minnesotans need to have safe conditions when they're in their homes, and that includes heat in cold temperatures or severe weather events. This is a point that's been reinforced by tribal leaders statewide as the department has consulted with those tribes, and in particular by the tribes in the northern part of the state that share the the northern part of the state that Minnesota shares geography with, the seven Ojibwe tribes. For tribal members, even with the addition of energy assistance, Native households still have the highest energy burden in the state. And so this is really important to address those issues. The administration knows the extension of the cold weather rule is not an end-all to problems for Minnesotans not being able to pay their utility bills, because they need an active payment plan and need to be making payments in order to qualify for the protections under this rule. If they can't do that, the utility is allowed to determine if there are additional actions they can take, including disconnection. So that's why, in coordination with this proposal, the department is actively engaged on the federal level to advocate for more resources to be directed at the federally funded energy assistance program, which the department oversees. The energy assistance program helps pay for home heating costs and furnace repairs for income qualifying households. It's a federally funded grant, which I mentioned before, funded by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, and grants are for renters or homeowners and for households with incomes at or below 50% of the state median income, based on energy cost, and the amount of the grant is based on energy cost, household size, and income. Through training, workshops, and marketing materials, the agencies hope that fewer people face the risk of having their heat disconnected. We're working with utilities more closely to ensure that members of those utilities who qualify are aware of the energy assistance and weatherization assistance programs. The extension of the cold weather rule and this increased outreach with utilities helps ensure all Minnesotans are able to weather the long winter safely. And we look forward to continuing our collaboration and this effort. So, Chair Long, thank you again, and members, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Temporary Commissioner Arnold. Representative Acom, would you like to introduce your next testifier?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I would like to introduce Chairman Dupuy from the Fond du Lac tribe.
Chairman Dupuy, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ujung Naganimus and Dizdakas, Nagachiwananga Nujubami Gizidu Dem. We do Kawashun Nungum Dashkutuyan Wajuchigiana, Kinan Naganima De Mani Duka, Kinan Naganimani Duk, Wabanung Jawanung Nagavinung Gaywe Igwitch. First of all, thank you, Representative Acom and Commissioner Arnold. My name is Kevin Dupuy. I'm the Fond du Lac chairman. I introduce myself in my language. That's what we are taught when we're young. When we introduce ourselves, we always introduce our language, who we are and where we come from. I am very honored to be here. I just need to say this before I can start. I got to sit through this whole thing, and it's very, very interesting. I wish I could sit through all of these energy meetings, and hopefully someday I can, but as of right now, there isn't much more that I can say that Commissioner Arnold and Representative Acom have stated. But we all know that, just bring up a little history if I can. So we all know that we had 200-year floods in 10 years. So, and we were affected greatly in Fond du Lac, and it changed our footprints from our watersheds to a floodplain. So we know climate change is real. and where we sit with Indigenous people is the highest economic, social, and medical disparities in the state of Minnesota and most of the country. We do know that climate change is real, and Commissioner Arnold made the statement of the cold weather issue of snowstorms coming after the time period. Well, that was the question that I had to comments during our consultation, is I brought that exactly up, that we're having more snowstorms, the weather is changing. 2 years and 3 years, we're going into a vortex. We're in one now. And so it continues to come to this point where climate change is real. And all I can do is reiterate the importance of the cold weather rule and changing that time period. And it's 2 weeks. It may be a long time for some to really look at it and a revenue principle, but it's very imperative. And I can speak for Indian Country and who I represent, but I think this affects everybody in the state of Minnesota. And I think by doing this, it sends that equity across the board and unilaterally that everybody has the same ability to extend this process. I really can't say any more than what has already been said, but just to reiterate from my position as the chairman of Fond du Lac, that we pursued this, we pushed this, it was our questions. We believe it's the right thing to do. I believe it's great legislation, and it's not just for tribal people or Indigenous people. This is for everybody in the state of Minnesota. And we go back to what the governor says is a Minnesota one. Some may agree, some may disagree, but the reality comes back to this, is that's the way we're looking at it. This will definitely affect and help everyone in the state of Minnesota. So again, I appreciate your time, and thank you. It was an honor to be here, Chair Long, Commissioner and Representative Ekam. Thank you, Miigwech.
Thank you, Chairman Dupuy, and you're welcome back in committee anytime you'd like. Appreciate you being here. Representative Ekam, any comments before we go to questions?
No, Mr. Chair, I think that covers it, and open to questions.
Great. Representative Swazinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a general question. How would this work? So, you know, obviously thinking about adding 2 weeks on the front, 2 weeks on the back end, and people receive their bills monthly. And by increasing it by 2 weeks, would it be essentially they would have to start not paying their bill in August? You know, so if you don't pay your August bill or your September bill, to October, you know, how does that process work with utilities and the experience that you would see? How does that jive by adding only 2 weeks instead of a month, or a month at the end or a month at the beginning? Just because, you know, if you start not paying, I mean, the normal cutoff times don't normally start in the summer because of heat. How does that work?
Representative Ekam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Swazinski. I'll take a stab at this, but I will also look to the commissioner to maybe follow up. I think that in order to qualify for the cold weather rule, you need to reach out to your utility and start the process and set up a payment plan in advance. And so it isn't as though you stop paying your bill and months later it gets turned off. You have to initiate that process. And so I think I have it under correctly. So maybe I'll turn it over to my testifiers to see if they have anything to add to that.
Acting Commissioner Arnold.
Thank you, Chair Long and Representative Ekam, and thank you, Representative Swazinski, for the question. I'll just say a couple things, and then I'll kick it over to my team to talk through some of the details. Our understanding from discussions with the utilities is that this is actually easier to administer because it starts at the beginning of the month. And the proposal changes the point at which you have a right to the payment plan and the disconnection. That lining that up with when a billing period starts is actually, we understand, to an advantage. But I'll kick it over to my team to see if there's anything they want to add about the details of the process.
Deputy Commissioner Renate.
No, Commissioner Arnold, you summarized it well. From our conversations with individual utilities, munis, and co-ops regarding disconnections. This would actually make it easier.
I see we have some help coming from our nonpartisan research team. Mr. Eliff?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to point out that the current statute requires to make all their customers aware of the cold weather rule sometime between September 1st and October 15th. To give them an advance notice of how they may go about the process. And I hadn't thought of this before today, but it may be that Representative Aikman's bill can be amended to put that notice period back a little further as well.
Representative Swazinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Obviously this committee for a couple of years, and we've been told that climate change is actually making our winter shorter and warmer. So how does this jive with that discussion that's been going on?
Representative Aikman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Swazinski. And while you're right, we have been told that our winters are warming in Minnesota. That doesn't make them any less winter. They're still winter and it's still cold. It may be overall warmer than it was and trending warmer, but that's just by a couple degrees. And so, whether it's 28 or 20 degrees, it's still cold and we need heat in our homes. So you're right, our climate is changing and our winters are warming, but not to the point where we don't need to have heat in our homes.
I'd also just add that we heard from, in our first hearing, testimony about increase in extreme weather events, which I think Commissioner Arnold pointed to. And we know that extreme weather events are increasing with climate change and that those may be, for example, some of the snowstorms that we've heard about outside of the window that we have right now. Representative Swazinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this question would be towards the commissioner, just how the process works through utilities in non-payment, because obviously when someone doesn't pay, the rest of the customers have to pick up that tab. So my question was, if a customer hasn't paid their bill, or maybe they created a payment plan, maybe they didn't keep up and they potentially owe the utility money. Does that debt follow that person if they move out of that utility, or does the Commerce Department or the commissioners, do they help collect those funds? Let's say it's a cooperative in Southwest Minnesota and someone moves into XL territory with non-payment, potentially because of this mandate or this rule change. Does the department help the collection? So when they actually, that individual, that customer moves into a different department because of this mandate through non-payment, allow for those payments to be returned to the folks that have not been paid? How does that work?
Temporary Commissioner Arnold.
Thank you, Chair Long. I'm going to turn this one over to my team. So
Deputy Commissioner Renati.
Thank you, Chair Long and Representative Swazinski. We don't have the Department of Commerce doesn't have a role in debt collection. But their bad debt would follow even if they switch to a different utility, but the department doesn't have a role in collecting that.
Representative Swazinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So you're saying that let's say you owed a utility $100 in Southwest Minnesota, that debt would then get transferred to a different utility and then it would be paid?
Deputy Commissioner Renati.
No, to my knowledge, Representative, it doesn't transfer to the it's like any other bad debt. It doesn't transfer to the new utility just because you switched your provider.
Yes, that was my understanding as well. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then Commissioner, just one last follow-up kind of along those lines. If the utilities could prove that they have a lot of write-offs in this particular area where they do have a lot of bills that aren't being paid, either through the winter rule or movements or things, would you actually open to help some of those collections? Because rather than just writing these things off because of state mandates and pushing that cost onto other customers, whether it be utility or other residentials, would the commissioners or the commissioner's office be open to maybe partaking some of the legislation that would help those utilities to rather spread those costs out because of the winter rule, allow that to be focused in so they don't have to just write that debt off? Because I've heard from a number of utilities, they do have a decent amount of write-offs where they just give up. You know, if it's $50, $60, $100, $200, they have to eat that cost and pass that to other customers. Because we're mandating shutoffs, we're mandating ons and offs, do you think it would be a proper role of the department to also then help if those utilities aren't able to collect those debts?
Deputy Commissioner Renati?
Yeah, so in our role as the consumer advocate with the Public Utilities Commission, Representative Swazinski, we in fact do evaluate utilities on how good they are at collecting a bad debt as part of, for example, a rate case. So just like we look at reliability metrics, we also look at a utility's performance in collecting bad debt. And so in some of the recent proceedings in front of the Utilities Commission, we have called out a few instances where they have been less than satisfactory in our assessment.
Representative Swazinski, any follow-up?
No, Mr. Chair, thanks for your time.
Representative Akam, any closing comments to your bill?
No, Mr. Chair, just thank you to members of the committee to hear about the proposed change to the cold weather rule.
Thank you, Representative Akam, for bringing this forward. Thank you, Chairman Dupuy and Acting Commissioner, for being with us today and for presenting this important bill. Members, that completes our agenda for today. Our next meeting is Thursday, February 5th at 10:30 a.m. And our Representative Swazinski, do you have a question?
Yes, I do. Just real quick, kind of more of a process with the previous bill. You know, obviously, I think that's going to labor and industry.
Yes.
Will that bill then be returning for markup and amendment opportunities in our committee, or is it it was just for informational? That's the only shot you have at it, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Swazinski, for the question. So we didn't have possession of the bill, so we couldn't bring it up for hearing today. I do know that Chair Eklund would like to hear the bill in his committee, and we're getting in touch with him to see what the timeline will be and when he wants to move that bill over. But certainly we won't move any. It will come to this committee before we move it to the floor. Representative Swazinski, did you have any other questions?
No, Mr. Chair, I'm done. Sorry about that. I was trying to get my hand down here.
No problem. Well, thank you all very much for a good meeting, and this remote meeting is adjourned.